Welcome to the London School of Economics and Political Science. My name is Peter Gunn, and firstly, I should congratulate you all for finding this small and very special area of London. I know many of you have travelled a long way and do not know London. Secondly, I congratulate you for bringing up your children so successfully that they have gained entrance to the London School of Economics. I'm not an employee of the LSE, but a parent. My daughter Alice is reading law and is just about to start her third year. The Friends and Family Office approached me to say they wanted a captain of industry to speak to you today, but as they were all busy, would I do it? As you progress through life, there are various milestones and life-defining moments. I attended a very small village school in Warwickshire, went on to a grammar school, and then in August 1969, a day which defined my life. I found out that I had achieved the required grades to be accepted by the London School of Economics, and a month later I made my way by train with one suitcase and a holdall to London to find my hall of residence and the LSE. I was a country bumpkin who did not know London and had never seen the LSE. It is so different today. The Friends and Family Programme was set up in 2003, and the first parent orientation day took place the following year, and hopefully by the end of the day all your concerns should have been addressed and you can relax as your child has now left home, temporarily at least. When I graduated, the country was in recession and it seemed everyone wanted to be an accountant. There were 50 applications for every position, but I was offered a training contract with not one but two leading international firms. Not because I was a high flyer, I considered myself to be a middle-of-the-road student who played first 11 cricket, second 15 rugby, and could often be found in the snooker room next to the old Three Tons bar. What set me apart was the fact that I went to the LSE. Having LSE on my CV has set me apart in a competitive world and gave me an undoubted advantage as I progressed up the career ladder so that I achieved far more than I could have dreamt of when I was at that village school in Warwickshire. When my daughter arrived here, she was wary of sharing a hall of residence flat with five strangers, but they all became great friends. Two of them were Americans who were not returning home for Christmas, so we invited them to stay with us, and Alice has since stayed with them in the States. A couple of weeks ago, nine students stayed overnight after Alice's 21st birthday. I must say that it was a pleasure to meet them. They are all intelligent and personable youngsters who should go far in life. Alice now has those magic words, London School of Economics, on her CV to face a very competitive world, and she has been offered and has accepted a training contract with a prestigious American law firm in their city office. Your children are to be congratulated. They are very special. Yes, they have hard work ahead of them, but exciting times. When I started at the LSE, I was taught by a very, very young lecturer who I knew would go far in life. In fact, she is now Professor Judith Rees, Director of the school. She is supported by three pro-directors who deputise for her and her sister in various aspects. It is now my pleasure to introduce one of these pro-directors, Professor Janet Hartley, who will give her State of the School address.
Good afternoon. I should introduce myself. I'm Janet Hartley. I'm the Pro-Director for Teaching and Learning, which means that I'm responsible for the student body in all aspects from admission to the school until they graduate. I'm also a Professor of International History, and my specialism is 18th century Russian history. I say that because otherwise I think people wonder who on earth I am. We're appointed to these roles as a secondment, and we are academics. Academics govern an academic institution. I'd like to reiterate the welcome. Welcome to the LSE. We're delighted to see you. We're delighted that this family programme exists. I think it's an excellent initiative. I'd like to also to repeat my congratulations to you on your offspring. It's not easy getting into the LSE. We have 15 applicants per place. It's very competitive. In terms of applications per place, we're the most competitive university in the country. Our A-level requirements some of the highest in the country. So your children are very clever. Actually, the timing is also very good. I should congratulate you on that as well. They've come this year and not next year. I have to say, I haven't been quite so clever about this myself. My youngest is 15. But this is a good year to come to university. So congratulations for that. Congratulations also in finding the Peacock Theatre. I've been here for over 20 years, and there are still some nooks and crannies in the LSE that I haven't really discovered. I've been asked to say something about the position of the school. I'll start with the bad news, if you like. Everybody knows here there's been a lot of adverse press coverage of the LSE over the last few months. You will know that our director, Sir Howard Davis, resigned because of that. That was a source of enormous regret, I think. We were very sorry that he went, because he was an excellent director and immensely well thought of, both in the LSE and outside the LSE. The result of the Libya affair is that we're waiting for a report, and a report will say what lessons we will learn from the Libyan affair, and when that happens, then we will consider that and implement the recommendations. But I'd like to stress that it's business as usual. We have a director, it's Professor Judith Rees. She's a professor of geography and environment. Before she took on the role of interim director, she was the director of the research centre, the Grantham Institute on Climate Change. So her own interests are of key importance in the world today. And also, she is LSE through and through. She taught our parent here. She was an LSE undergraduate, an LSE master's student, an LSE PhD student. She was an LSE pro-director under the previous director, Anthony Giddens. And, of course, I would say she's a woman, the first female director that we've had at the LSE, and she knows the institution through and through, and it's very much business as usual. And she will be addressing your children next week in her sort of introduction to the LSE. What are the business of the school? I started with the bad news, in a way, but there's a lot of things that are very good about the school, a lot of things that we're very proud of at the school. In research, you've always scored extremely highly in whichever international table you look at, first or third, depending on how you look at it. We're delighted that we had a Nobel Prize winner in economics last year, Professor Chris Vissarides. And I think it is a reflection that he's been at the school since he was a PhD student, that in the days afterwards, his whole door was covered with stickers from his students sort of congratulating him. In tables, we're fairly sceptical about tables, but it's easier to be sceptical, of course, if you do well. And over the last year, we have done rather well, certainly in domestic tables. We've come out third or fourth. That's two or three places below where we would like to be, but it's still not that bad. And we've done particularly well this year, an improved position at least, in the National Student Survey. That's a survey completed by third-year undergraduates. We're making developments in the estate. You will have noticed, coming to this theatre, the placards around what is going to be a new student services centre, which should open in 2013. Summer 2013, I have to say, I'm afraid, rather than autumn 2013. But nevertheless, it should be open, it should be operating for at least the last year of the time when your children are here. That's quite a new development for us. It's a very innovative architectural design, which the Students' Union helped to choose. It will have new facilities for the Students' Union, for careers, an interface centre, space for societies. And I think it will greatly enhance the student experience and the estate of the LSE generally. You would have seen, or if you haven't yet been on a tour, you'll be shown our new academic building, which was opened a few years ago by the Queen, and also the Land Registry building that we've just acquired this year, and again will be up and running in 2013, the beginning of 2013. So we feel we're making improvements to the estate, and we needed to make improvements to the estate. I think the idea in the past that people would sort of put up with shoddy buildings simply because there's a great place of learning no longer really holds true. People want to work in a good environment. Teachers want to teach in a good environment, and we do think that we're creating that. Extracurriculum activities, well, I think Alex will probably say a little bit more about that, but we have an immensely lively student body. And it's something that I think can go all too quickly years at university. We would encourage you to encourage your children to participate fully in that, to take advantage of it, and to take advantage of the fact that the LSE, I think, above all institutions, does engage with the real world, does face the real world. And one of the consequences of that is that we have an absolutely stunning public lecture programme at the LSE. Leaders of the world want to come and talk at the LSE. One of the ones that I enjoyed most, because I'm a Russian historian, was when President Medvedev came here from Russia. But they do come, they do speak, and it is a quite extraordinary opportunity, in a way, to hear these people talk, and indeed to question them at the LSE. Well, that may seem like a rather sort of PR rosy speech, and I think it'd be wrong of me not to admit that there are anxieties in the sector, not exclusively at the LSE, but across the sector, and in fact, you know, in many ways we're in a very strong position at the LSE to deal with them, but there are anxieties nevertheless. We are concerned about the new fee structure. That's one of the reasons why we, in fact, almost uniquely amongst top universities, set an 8.5 fee and not a 9 fee. We're worried about the image it will give to students who are not from a background where they've been to university, where parents have been to university, students who are not from wealthy backgrounds. We're worried about the way in which they're going to perceive this. We're particularly worried at the LSE about the sort of behavioural patterns of students. The government has instructed us to make available to students their income 6 months after graduating. Well, Jenny from Careers will tell you that we're normally top or second in the list for this. But nevertheless, we have an unease about this, that subjects should be presented to students in terms of what they might gain after 6 months in terms of salary. And that's something I'll come back to in a moment. But I certainly understand the concerns of parents, and I understand the concerns of students about simply what the future is going to bring. I think our other great area of anxiety is about visa restrictions. And that may not be quite so relevant to you in this audience, but we are, of course, a completely international body at the LSE. We have students from 140 countries in the world. Almost every country is represented at the LSE. I believe there's even one student, was a student once from Greenland, so we do have almost every country covered, every continent. And our staff as well are very international. We are a sort of global university. So visa restrictions, both for students and for staff, are something, again, where I think there's a degree of unease in the system. We want the best at the LSE, we want the best staff and the best students. And this sort of government policy is something that gives us cause for concern. Having given you that sort of general outline, I'm just going to say a little bit more about teaching at the LSE, because I'm the pro-director, teaching and learning. There are three pro-directors at the school. One of them deals with resources and planning. That's Professor George Gaskell. And in fact, he's going to say something at the reception this evening. He's in charge of money, really. One of them is the pro-director for research and for international partnerships. So he's involved in research. And I think I have the core job, really. I would think that, I suppose. You know, I'm in charge of the student body, teaching and learning at the school. I've been in this post for 4 years. This is my last year, so I think I can sort of reflect a little bit on what's happened in those 4 years. The student body here is absolutely stunning. I mean, I said that, you know, that it's very competitive. It is very competitive. The standards are very high. The students who come also, I think because of the nature of the LSE, want to engage, want to discuss, are active in class, and in that respect, I think your students, children are very good to get to the LSE, but from our perspective as teachers, we're enormously privileged to teach them. And from my perspective as a pro-director, teaching and learning, I'm enormously privileged to have this post. The students are excellent. We're very lucky. But when I took over as pro-director, I have to say that I thought we'd slipped slightly and we hadn't quite got the same level of excellence in teaching as we had in research. So I set up what we called a teaching task force in my first year that took a whole range of recommendations, 40 recommendations through our academic board, all of which were approved. And since that time, I think we've improved training of teachers, we've improved support for teachers, we've improved reward for good teachers, we've encouraged innovation in teaching, whether it's through Moodle, or whether it's through different forms of feedback, different forms of assessment. And I think in many ways we have done something to actually get a higher profile to teaching in the LSE. And I think that is reflected, or beginning to be reflected at least, in the fact that we're now going up in the National Student Survey. But beyond that, I wanted to talk about one particular innovation that we introduced as part of the Teaching Task Force, which will directly affect your children this year and next year, and I suppose I hope for the rest of their lives. And that was, when we came to look at teaching, we felt that somehow we were missing a trick at the LSE. Here we are, we're a social science institution where more or less we can talk to each other. Not always, you know, sometimes one has to talk to statisticians, but for the most part, we can talk to each other. A historian can talk to a geographer, an anthropologist can talk to a lawyer, an economist can talk to, hang on, yeah, an economist can talk to somebody, I'm sure. But we are more or less in the same intellectual area. It's not like other universities where I have taught before coming to the LSE, but it's actually quite hard for a classicist to talk to a chemical engineer. Here at the LSE, we do share a certain intellectual background. We look at some of the same problems, albeit from different angles. I can share my research, although it may sound rather esoteric to you, 18th century Russian history. I've shared it with anthropologists, I've shared it with lawyers, I've shared it with economists, because everything sort of cuts across different areas. And we felt that somehow with our student body, perhaps we were missing out on this. Students come to the LSE to study law, or to study economics, or to study economic history, and somehow we hadn't brought it all together. We also felt that, you know, in terms of student mix, again, students were becoming slightly atomized within their own subject area, and we had a duty, in a way, to push them into other directions. I think it's also the case that the students here are absolutely first-rate, and there was a feeling among some of us that we weren't really pushing that enough. They might become first-rate lawyers or first-rate economists, but perhaps they hadn't become first-rate social scientists. So that was the thinking behind a course that evolved my first year as pro-director, which now has the perhaps not terribly imaginative title of LSE 100. The idea of this course is that it introduces all our students, whatever discipline and background they are, to big questions in the social sciences. Why are some countries rich and some countries poor? Who is to blame that some countries are rich and some countries are poor? Who caused the financial crisis? Why do wars happen? Why did the Cold War end? Is there such a thing as equality? It was these sorts of questions, which I think you can see are of sort of fundamental importance, that we felt all our students should address. And then we felt they should address them through different disciplines. You can approach why are some countries rich and some countries poor through statistics, through economics, through history, through anthropology, through even, if you like, philosophy. So we put together a course, or my colleagues did, which they felt would address this. The other motivation, or one of the other motivations behind this, was a feeling, which I know as many parents that you share, that undergraduates sometimes get a raw deal, that sometimes they don't see the big stars. They can see the big stars, you know, there in the corridor, Crispus Arides carrying his tray with his food at lunchtime. They don't necessarily hear them lecture. And of course, we have big stars that run across all sorts of different subject areas. So the idea of this is, when we talk about climate change, we will have Nick Stern talking about climate change and giving the lecture, and all undergraduates at the LSE will hear him give that lecture. And I think that too was part of the thinking behind it, that all our students should be exposed to our big names. So this was behind the idea of the course LSE 100. It started initially as a pilot. It was implemented for the first time for all students last year, so your children are not guinea pigs. We've gone through a whole cycle of it. And for the most part, I think we feel, you know, it's fulfilled what we wanted it to fulfill. You can always change and shift and improve it, but it seems to have worked. So this year and next year, your children will take this course. It's an examined course. They do get distinction, merit, or pass, but it doesn't count towards the classification of their degree. So in that respect, we feel that it's something that should open their minds, should be stimulating. If I'm being more pragmatic, it should also be very useful to them. There was an idea that, you know, all these skills have to be shared. You can be a brilliant mathematician, but actually, 10 years into your job after graduating from the LSE, you have to write a report, so you have to learn how to write. You can be a great historian, but then when you become pro-director, you have to actually understand a balance sheet. And it was actually quite difficult for me to do that. So I think that that's, that sort of practical element was also one that was very important. So that's something that we've introduced this year, next year, and it's something that we believe will very much enhance the experience of students at the LSE. And we also hope they'll go out as LSE students. That's a very difficult thing, I think, also to conjure with. They can go out as geographers, philosophers, economists, but we wanted, I think, in some way, to them to go out as LSE students. And LSE 100, I think, was part of that. It would be a shared experience. There are many other ways in which they're going to go out, we hope, go out from the LSE as LSE students. We hope that during 3 years here, they will be challenged in whatever subject they take. We hope we will challenge their orthodoxies. We hope we will teach them how to think for themselves, how to tell rubbish from the truth, how to analyse, irrespective of what subject that they cover, whether it's geography or philosophy. And I think we hope, too, they will gain a love of their subject, and they've chosen to do a particular subject. I know that in many cases the subjects have been chosen with rather pragmatic aims of then, you know, becoming a lawyer or becoming an economist, but we hope they will also acquire a love of the subject. We hope they will become global citizens. I mean, I mentioned at the beginning we have students from 140 countries in the world. It's not a natural thing to do, I think, simply to cross cultures. I think that sometimes it's thought that, you know, it's an easy thing to do, and within weeks students will become somehow international. I don't think that happens automatically, but we hope that over the 3 years that students study here, they'll become sensitive to other students, to other issues, to international issues, whether it's in the classroom, whether it's in LSE 100, whether it's joining student societies, whether it's attending debates. So we're fairly confident we will be able to achieve that, but we hope that too. Well, as I sort of finish, can I just say that, again, welcome to the LSE. We're delighted that your children chose to come to the LSE. We realise that they could have chosen to go somewhere else. So we're very, very pleased they chose to come to us. We very much looking forward to enjoying teaching them, to enjoy having them on the campus, hoping that their energy that has brought them here will carry through their 3 years. We hope very much they have a wonderful time at the LSE, and we hope very much that you will be happy and you will be very pleased after 3 years that your children chose to come to the LSE. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Janet, for that. We'll now be hearing from five speakers who cover key areas around the school. And when he's mic'd up, we'll be hearing from Gavin Eaves, who is the Student Advice and Reception Manager.
Thank you. Yes, I hope everyone can hear me. I've not used this particular mic in the past, so it's a brave new world for me. I'm going to talk for about 10 minutes on some of the support services that are available to students around the school, and to give you a little bit more of an understanding of how the undergraduate programmes work as well. I also want to pass on, as Janet and Peter have done, my congratulations to both your sons and daughters and to yourselves in the incredible achievement they have made in coming to the LSE. There's some more numbers to throw at you there, that we get at least 18,000 applications every year for the few undergraduate places that we have at the school. When students do arrive, they're obviously arriving to a very exciting environment in the centre of London, and it's a very cosmopolitan environment on campus as well. The way that the demographics break down is that there's about a 50-50 split between students who are doing undergraduate programmes here and students who are doing taught graduate or research degrees at the school. And similarly, there's a big split in terms of students who are from the UK, from the European Union, and an awful lot of students from outside Europe as well who study here. I think it's about 50-50 on undergraduate programmes, but there's perhaps a predominance of overseas students at the graduate level. The way that the undergraduate courses operate is that students will be here for 3 years. They'll study normally 4 courses each year, which will be a mixture of optional courses and core courses that make up their programme. Some of those courses will take place in their home departments. Other courses will take place across the school. In addition to those 4 courses, there's, of course, as Janet was outlining, LSE 100, which is now in its second year and is a bonus 5th course for undergraduates, which is taught across 2 different years. So students will start that course in their second term of their first year and complete the course in the first term of their second year at the school. The main courses that they study as part of their degree programme, the teaching on those courses is split between large group lectures, much like this, and much smaller classes. And the classes are compulsory for students to attend. Similarly, all coursework that students are expected to complete, that's compulsory as well. And we do monitor to make sure that students are doing the work that we expect of them. Although much of the coursework they do is only formative, it doesn't count towards their final class grades, it's considered essential because it's a perfect way of reinforcing students' learning, and it also means that they can check their progress, and we can check their progress to make sure that they are progressing successfully towards, hopefully, doing very well in the final exams. And all of the courses that students study here will be assessed by a final exam in May and June each summer. There's an awful lot of academic support for students. The most important person probably is their academic advisor. That's a member of academic staff within their home department who's allocated to every undergraduate student at the school. And they're expected to meet with their academic advisor at least once a term, and certainly more regularly than that when students first arrive at the school. There's also a departmental tutor who oversees the work of academic advisors in the department, and again is also an academic member of staff. Academic advisors do get notifications if students are missing coursework or are missing classes, so they can check in with students and see if they're having a bad time or if they're having too good a time, and then they can obviously take the most appropriate action. There's also a dean for undergraduate students and an associate dean for students on the general course programme, and both of those members of staff are an excellent source of advice and support to students at the school. And they will be delivering presentations at the beginning of next week to all of the new students. So as well as getting a welcome from the director, they'll also hear information very similar to this, but more eloquently delivered from the deans of the school. In terms of central support services, there's the Teaching and Learning Centre, which does an awful lot of work with students in terms of study skills. That can take the form of workshops or one-to-one support on almost any area you can think of. It goes right across the school, right across any level of study, helping at the start of the year with transition to studying at university level, dealing with reading lists, coping with the different requirements of studying at a university compared to studying for A-levels, looking at exam techniques, preparing for revisions, looking at particular problems in technical subjects such as maths and stats or with essay writing, almost anything you can think of. They're an additional resource outside of the individual academic departments that students should try and make use of. There's also a language centre which, as you would expect, offers language courses to students. That's something that can form part of a degree programme or just be an extracurricular activity for students. And also, for anyone studying here with English as a second language, the Language Centre offers additional support for those students as well. I'm based in the Student Services Centre, and it's made up of a multitude of different teams that provide all sorts of advice to students on financial issues, on visa matters, on academic regulations. We also house the registry. They take care of the student record throughout the whole life cycle of the student, so from the registration, which is going to happen next week, through to the exams in the summer, and hopefully for the incoming students, the graduation ceremonies they'll be attending in 3 years' time. For my team has a varied number of responsibilities, and the one I wanted to highlight to you is the student mentoring scheme. We do pair all new undergraduate students with an existing undergraduate student at the school. In almost all cases, it's somebody in their own department. For the first time this year, we've managed to do the allocation of mentors to new students much earlier than in the past, so that hopefully, a couple of weeks or so ago, every new student was contacted by their mentor to see if they had any particular questions or concerns before they arrived on campus. So I hope that that has been of assistance to our new arrivals. And even if new students don't have any questions that they want to ask of their mentor, I would very much encourage them to take advantage of the invitation to meet up next week, because the mentors will be meeting up in their mentoring groups of about 5 to 10 students. And it's a brilliant way for new arrivals to get to meet other people that are studying within their department, probably on the same programme. And so before they even set foot inside a classroom, they've already got a small network of friends. So hopefully, through the mentoring scheme, it makes the transition to studying in a completely different environment, an alien environment, a little bit easier for new students. I'll mention a bit more about the Financial Support Office as well, because that's particularly important if students do have any financial issues, that they get in touch with this support service as soon as possible. They can assess students for support, whether it's because of a temporary problem, that they're waiting for funds to arrive and need some assistance over a short period of time, or if it's on a more ongoing basis. But any students who've experienced unexpected financial issues should get in touch with the Financial Support Office as soon as possible to get potential support. And that forms part of a much wider pastoral care network at the school. If students do have personal issues, any concerns they want to raise, they can get in touch with anybody that I've mentioned so far. But in addition to those people, there's also a chaplaincy, a counselling service, an advisor to male and female students, there's a student union advice service. There's also a disability and wellbeing service, and I'd want to make particular mention of this, so that any students who've got a physical disability or mental health issues or dyslexia or any students that could benefit from being in touch with the disability office need to register with them as soon as possible, because what they'll be able to do is put in place an individual student support agreement, which would then make certain adjustments to students' studies at the school to make sure that their disability isn't in any way a barrier to them studying successfully. So it's important that students do that as soon as they possibly can if that service is going to be useful to them. And the final thing that I would stress, more than anything else, is that it's very easy coming to university to treat it in the same way as students have treated school, and that they put all the emphasis on their timetabled classes and assume that that is what LSE is all about. And I think Janet has given some indication that that really isn't the case. There's an awful lot more to studying at university that students need to take advantage of. I hope I've given you some sense that there's a lot of support there for students if they do need it to prevent problems occurring, or if there's any difficulties, there's lots and lots of people that they can get in touch with to get support. I do realise how hard students have worked to get here, and I very much look forward to helping them make the most of their time studying at the school. Thank you.
Hello everybody, can you hear me? Great, hello. My name is Rachel Elliott and I'm Head of Residential Life here at the LSE. I have the deep joy and privilege of working with over 150 of my colleagues who work within the LSE Halls of Residence, where new undergraduate students will be living at least for the next year or so. My role, along with the role of wardens and other live-in staff in the LSE halls, is to make sure that the student experience here is as positive as it can be, and to support their success in their studies here at the school. There is a responsibility there for pastoral care and welfare of students in halls. So I hope that this is a reassuring message for you, that in fact there are a number of us who are both experienced and do have a genuine concern for student welfare while students are here at the school. I'd just like to take a few minutes to tell you about what the living experience in LSE and to some extent the University of London intercollegiate halls will be like, and how students can seek support if they need it. Alex, who's the Student Union General Secretary, will explain very much how the Students' Union bring to life the student experience at LSE. And very much this is played out in the halls, where of course students mix and meet and mingle for the first time with very many of their peers, and of course all of the staff who have the experience of supporting students. So, as I mentioned, it's a community of about 10 halls of residence dotted around in different parts of London, and including the intercollegiate halls, there is a community of about 4,000 students and staff who live in the halls there. The halls are, in fact, very close to LSE. Those of you that are familiar with London or perhaps living in other urban environments will appreciate that, you know, the challenge of public transport and travel to get to university means that actually achieving a 30-minute travel time to get from a university hall into LSE is in fact a real bonus for students. We place very much a lot of emphasis on the safety, security, and having a welcoming environment for students. And that's why there is a school commitment to a place for every new undergraduate who joins the school each year. There is, of course, the residential staff are a cross-section of some very senior academic staff who perform the very vital role of warden within the school, within the residences. But also there are other managers that live in too. LSE residences are great places to work, and they're certainly fantastic places to live, because for me, they're a microcosm of London life. Immersed in an urban environment, living cheek by jowl with very many people. Some of the services that are available to students, LSE students in halls of residence. We have a commitment to prioritising students who have particular needs. So students who have a disability or any other kind of support requirement are prioritised for accommodation through the entirety of their studies, not just for the first year. As Gavin's already mentioned, within the school environment, there is a network of professional pastoral and welfare care personnel, and the hall wardens and residential staff are connected, of course, to that network. As I speak, very many of the elected committee members from each hall, there is an active student governance model in every LSE hall. They're all busy getting ready with social activities and other kind of information and question and answer sessions for students who are arriving this weekend. So there's a very vibrant social life in LSE halls, which if any of you are helping students to move in at the weekend, then hopefully you'll experience for yourself as well. LSE halls not only just, of course, provide places, supported places for students to live, but they also provide part-time employment. We have almost 40 research students who perform the very vital role of sub-warden within halls. And this means that on a 24/7 basis, there is always someone that an LSE student who lives in an LSE hall can contact if they need to seek help. There's also, as I've mentioned, the hall social committees. They run very active social programmes. And these are a real aid to transition to university life and to facilitate friendships, which we hope, of course, students will go on to make for the rest of their lives. Some practical information now. The school organises payment arrangements for halls of residence over a term basis. And although we do publish this information in advance, I thought I'd bring it with me today to let you know, in case students don't let you know, when the payment deadlines for university halls are. Not only do we have a range of halls of residence, but we also have other services for students, including for students who will find themselves leaving halls of residence next year, looking for accommodation in the private housing sector. We have, again, professional advice and staff available to give guidance in the form of a temporary housing office. And we also have talks at particular times of the year, time to give support for individuals who want to move out of university halls. And we also supply, of course, reference requests and other vital administration, so that actually, the transition out of halls into living in the local London community can be free from worry. So I thought I'd just add in this question at the end, which is really about, you know, perhaps how you can help. University should, of course, be a life-changing experience in a very positive way. And when I reflect on how to support students, I always have to remind myself that this is a period of very, very rapid change, and that changes will occur. We hope that, you know, they'll have meaningful relationships, and we'll work hard to make sure that students are supported, but they have a balanced life as well. And not to study too hard, that they should make space for fun as well. It's important that they have a platform to meet with other students, to be able to share any issues that they have. I'd like to reassure you that a student experience would be problem-free, but I think that's probably unrealistic. Things will come up in halls of residence that you may hear about: problems with kitchens, sharing rooms, bathrooms, noise, guests. All of these are very common occurrences in community living. But all I'd reassure you about is that it is possible for students, as I said, 24/7 to seek help, and for them not to feel alone and always feel as though that they have someone to talk to. Thank you very much.
I'll start chatting while I'm wiring up, because my voice will carry. Mute, is this live? Not yet. Yes, it is. So I can go in the pocket. Need to move my slide over. Wonderful. That's who I am. Frightening to see one's name writ large all the way across a platform like that. I actually thought it was going to be one big slide going all the way along, because I will walk up and down a bit. Maybe that'll frighten you, I'm not quite sure. It's nice to see lots of mums and dads. I can see brothers and sisters as well, which is most encouraging. And this isn't clipping on too well. I think I've won. Success, yeah? Okay, great. Quite frightening to see one's name up there. You think, God, fees manager, how deadly can that be? And I'll try my best not to make it too deadly. To ease you off a little bit, I actually spent 15 years as a school teacher before breaking out of that and turning into an accountant and ending up here. I've spent 21 fantastic years at the LSE. I have loved every single day of my work, and I still love every single day of my work in meeting each and every one of your children, because they are wonderful, and you think that fees could be deadly with them, but it really isn't. And let's move on and have a little look. Why? What do we do? Come on, click, click, click. Got it. This is what I'm supposed to talk about: our role, the fee-paying structure, and giving advice to you. But the most important thing is the bit that says we are here to help. And I'll try to give you an idea on that. Click. Wonderful. That's it. That's the team. We're quite small. There's only six of us, it looks on that picture. Actually, there's one more making seven, but she wasn't there the day we took that photograph. And you can see that not all our staff are good at having their photograph taken. You can see one hiding here behind Huey at the back. They're also quite diverse. The guy on the end here, Huey, he was actually an Olympic athlete, and he ran in the final of the 110-metre hurdles at Barcelona. So we have quite a diverse squad who are then going to look after your students. And we look after an awful lot of them. I was going to say about, but I have the number so firm in my head, how can you say about? 11,517 students is how many we will look after this year. Just seven of us. So we tend to be a little stretched, but we do still manage nevertheless. Come on, move over, move over, move over. Go nearer. Wonderful. Most people seem to think that anything to do with fees or finance means that we are probably somewhere close to the spawn of Beelzebub. But I try as far as possible to make sure we're not. We really are very warm, caring people, and we very carefully look after all of our little students. Students have actually seen part of this because the teddy bear you're looking at is called Steve. And if you come into a student presentation about US loans and Canadian loans and things like that, then you see what else happens to Steve in the story. Not only do we look after our students, but we have a Customer First Award. It's a national recognition for the way we look after our customers. It doesn't mean we're brilliant, because if we think we're brilliant, we know we're doomed for fall. We're not. We know we have faults, and what we hope that we do is if we get anything wrong for any of your offspring, for our students, that we get it right as far as possible. It's a good award to have, Customer First. Right. So, some of you have driven in from the UK. Some have sailed in from the EU. Others have flown in from overseas. Yet, whichever you have done, we have a payment plan to suit you. Nothing like taking the money, is there? We do a lot of other things besides taking money, you know. Payment plan. So how does it actually work? All of you are going to be affected by this, whether you like it or not. We have an academic year which breaks, as far as we're concerned, from payments in October 28. You don't have to remember this. It's on the website. Payments on the 28th of October, running through to the end of the year, September 28. And we allow you to choose any five payment months in that. All we want is that something turns up at the first of it. Now, that's the bit you're not allowed to have. You must make at least one payment before October, or at least before the 28th of October. I thought this was going to be quite a big picture all the way along, so I'd start here with this is the beginning of the year, so one payment before the 28th of October. You can make anything up to four more during that lovely period going the right the way through to about May at the end, and then obviously making your final payment just before we hit May the 28th, which hopefully is when your little blossoms have more than started their exams, but are actually quite close to the end of them. This doesn't like being away, does it? Okie dokie. Who's from not the UK? Few people not the UK. Okay, wonderful. We know that you guys have money coming from governments that are not UK, and that changes things slightly, and it really isn't a problem. For people like the Americans, the Canadians, and for a large chunk of the world, the money for student loans tends to come in three blobs. One somewhere around October, a second one somewhere around January, and a third one somewhere around May. Anybody here from Scandinavia? Yep, right. We know that your system doesn't work well till about December, and we're very much on top of that. Belgium's? Nope, okie dokie. Quebec? Oh, wonderful. That was easy, wasn't it? So we know that they work, and we're very understanding. Just talk to us and tell us that your government money isn't coming the way we'd expect it to be, and we'll change the payment plan for you. Student loan company. How many are dealing with the student loan company? Probably many of you. Wonderful. Their stuff is different because they say we will pay the LSE in February and in May, and we don't have any problem with that at all. The advice I do have to give you is that when you're renewing with the student loan company each year, the value of the fees goes up slightly. For the past few years, it's going up by about £25. And lots of students just renew their loan without actually checking the value. And it wastes an awful lot of our time, your time as parents, and the students' time, realising, oh, it's gone up by £25, I've got to call the student loan company, arrange a slightly different loan. Not a problem, but just be aware of it. I've told you about that. That can go. Oh, yes. And here's the hard bit. Anybody here born in 1952? Wonderful. So those born in 1952 will remember on the 18th of May 1970, the law changed and the age of majority became 18. And those of us who were able to make our cross on the election paper that first year, it was fantastic. We were so grown up. Well, we thought we were anyway. And so we became responsible for all sorts of things. And the trouble with being responsible for all sorts of things is suddenly we don't want to tell the parents. It's our secret. Whatever we do is for us to know and not for our parents to know. That can be quite hard. And you think, so how are you going to find things out with your offspring? Well, they have a thing called LSE4U. And on LSE4U, they can see their information. They can see on here what they're doing. They can see all about their payments and things like that. And you can't see this because they're over 18. So they are the adults completely in their own right. And whether we like it or not as parents, we're shut out of that a bit. The Data Protection Act says it belongs to them and to nothing else. Your students, your children, can also see who's paying their fees. If the SLC is, it'll show there. And a little warning is that for students saying, I can't see the SLC as my sponsor, don't panic, because the information we get from the SLC is often quite late. So up to about the end of October, the information might not be quite right, and we'll turn over. And we do tell the students this very forcibly. We send emails out regularly saying, this is what's going on. If you know something we don't, come and talk to us. And you think, why on earth do I have a packet of Polo mints? And the question, of course, is, will your children tell you what on earth is going on with their fees or with anything else in their lives? The Polo mints, because in my teaching days, I did some work for the Open University teaching a course called Parents and Teenagers. And in the course called Parents and Teenagers, a large chunk of that was working with parents and saying, what are your recollections of being young? Do you remember that lovely TV advert for the washing powder where the lad comes home with a bag full of washing and talks about what a fantastic rock concert it was, and the more he goes on about how wonderful it was, and Mum just turns around at the end and says, well, of course, in my day, we just didn't wear clothes. And that very much still goes on, because what did we do, our generation, with our magic Polo mints that we thought was going to cover up the smell of cigarettes or the smell of alcohol, whereas slightly younger or slightly older teenagers, we thought we were going to fool our parents. And so for all of us as well, you know, we assume that they're going to tell us everything. We didn't tell our parents, so why should we assume our kids are going to tell us? I suppose to some extent we're going to have to wait for that first break when they come home, complete with a washbox that's full and a wallet that's empty. And once we get that point, then you are in a situation to be able to talk to your children. Ask them what's going on. Say, show me what's going on with your fees. Show me what's going on in your life. Show me what's going on in your bank account. Show me how you're managing with your money. But also, the advice part we have to give now is, be honest. Be very, very honest. We, as parents, did all sorts of things we would never expect. Sorry, we as children did all sorts of things we would never expect our parents to find out or to ever have done. The fact that here we are now as parents, and we've done all this before, why should we assume that our children think we don't? Talk to them. Trust is very hard. And advice I always used to give is, share your experience of being young with your offspring. They will find it shocking, because all parents were never young, only ever old. Encourage sharing. Encourage your experiences to share with them. How did you survive in university? How did you first work out that if you don't prick the little hole in the top of the egg before you put it in the pan, you're going to have a watery pan full of white mush when you try and boil it? And that if you don't put oil in the frying pan when you put your fried egg on it, it's going to taste absolutely revolting. Share with them. Give them guidance. Understand them and support them so they feel comfortable to talk to you. And we'd also say, so it also makes them comfortable to talk to us as well. So that when they come to you in that first break with a pile of washing and the empty wallet, you actually have some understanding of what's going on. And you're not giving them the confidence or not giving them the idea that they're in any sense of failure or that anything might be going wrong. Ultimately, get them to talk to us. For us, absolutely nothing is new. We do understand your students. We do understand your children. We've been there. We've done it, just as you have done too. And as long as they can talk to us and talk to you, nobody should be having problems, and we can sort them out. I hope that's not too dry in terms of how things go about fees and finance. We are available to students every day between 2 and 3. That doesn't sound like a long time. And I said to some students yesterday, I was talking to some Americans, and I said, right, there's 6 of us. There are 3 people down in student services right now. There's me and my deputy standing here lecturing to you now. So how many are left in the office? Which I then had to say, I do hope none of you are studying to do your masters in maths. We are available. Our email address is extremely easy, fees@, and the rest you can work out for yourself. We have an easy phone number, 7765, and students can actually see us all any time they want to. They can book an appointment, and if they talk to any member staff who thinks they don't have the authority or the ability to handle the problem, they will pass the students on to either me or to my deputy. And where did I get to after that? Oh, yes. When students do get passed on to us, sometimes there are horrendous stories of what they've got up to, that we have dug them out of the hole they've dug themselves into. This time isn't long enough to share those stories with you, but if anybody would like to hear some toe-curling stories or some fantastic stories of how students have done, do grab me at the reception over a glass of wine. I'm more than happy to share with you. I hope that's not too boring, and how to make finance and fees sound reasonably interesting.
Tough act to follow. So my name's Jenny Owen. I'm director of the Career Service, or LSE Careers as we call it here. And I thought I'd talk to you a little bit about some of the questions that we get asked a lot. So these are the questions that come to me most often. What kind of work do LSE graduates do? Although I have to say that that's more often phrased as, do they get proper jobs? Simple answer to which is yes, so it'll be fine. What are employers looking for? How do we support students to develop those skills? And what does the Career Service have to offer to your sons and daughters? One of the things that the Career Service is required to do by the UK government is to follow every single graduate up 6 months post-graduation and ask them what it is that they're doing now. Quite often, because the data we've got on their personal records is your phone numbers, we quite often phone you up and ask you what your sons and daughters are doing. With apologies to dads in the room, I spend a lot of time on the phones in the January when we do the call centre, and inevitably if we get someone's dad and we say, hello, we're ringing from the LSE, I'm finding out what John Smith's doing now, he says, hold on, I'll get his mum. So if you get a phone call from us, this is why. So we follow everyone up 6 months post-graduation to find out what they're doing immediately upon leaving the LSE. And the data you see on the screen there is from the most recent survey that's been published. So this is for students who graduated 6 months prior to this summer. So people that graduated summer 2009/10. So over 95% of our students were either working in graduate level jobs or were completing further study, so had gone on to PhDs or masters. The average starting salary was £33,608. As Janet referred to in her speech at the start here, I'm always a little bit wary about quoting those figures. I know that you're interested, and I know that your sons and daughters are interested, particularly following a talk about fees and the fee regime. Actually, it varies wildly between programmes. And for me, as somebody that works as a careers professional, what's important is that we help the students here develop fulfilling careers, and that success isn't necessarily determined by salary. And for all of us who work in higher education, if success was determined by salary and that was our driving force, we wouldn't be sat up here now. So we also follow students up 3 years after they've graduated so that we can make sure that it's not just about getting them their first job, but that they're still maintaining successful careers in that time post-graduation. And what we found then is that actually they are earning better than their peer group. So it's a third higher than the national average, their average salary, and over 99% of our alumni are in employment. And what we tend to find is that those that aren't in employment are not in employment out of choice. So they've decided to go travelling, or they're actually mature students and they've retired, or what have you. What kind of work do they do? Will not come as a great surprise to you to find that at the London School of Economics, a large percentage of our students go on to work in the banking, financial services and accountancy industry. But as you can see, they also go into a wide range of sectors, so from education, NGOs, research, IT, right down to energy. I thought I'd be brave and try for a bit of audience participation. So in raw numbers, can anybody take a guess at who was the biggest employer of LSE students last year? Name me a firm or an organisation. PwC, somebody said? Any more takers? Oh, heckled from the back. Anybody else? Civil service. If I had chocolates, they'd be yours. The top recruiters of LSE students last year were the UK Civil Service and the United Nations, both of whom took on 41 LSE graduates last year. PwC, very close, third place, followed by Barclays Capital, KPMG, Citigroup, starts to get a bit banking dominated. When you look at the spectrum of what our students go on to do, it is incredible. We have got LSE alumni and graduates in every kind of organisation you can imagine. And I think for the students, partly because a lot of students come here and do have a focus on the financial services sector or on the city in the first instance, they can feel a bit like we're a sort of training ground for the investment banks in the first instance. And if they want to treat this as a training ground for the investment banks, brilliant. We can help them out with that. There's clear pathways. We're heavily targeted. If they want to go and work in NGOs or charity sectors, we are targeted heavily by those people as well. The Career Service actually runs a scheme called Friends of LSE, which is for third sector organisations who want to partner with us and create a talent pipeline into their businesses. They can do so, and we aid them to do that and to come onto campus, deliver skill sessions to the students, take them on for internships, etc. So what is it employers are looking for, and how can we help them present that to students? About 60% of graduate vacancies in the UK don't specify a degree discipline. So the ones that do, you'll be pleased to know, are things like medicine, dentistry. I think it's best that those people are specifically qualified in their field. But for the rest of them, actually what people are looking for is aptitude, the ability to learn, people that have got really agile minds and that will be able to contribute to the workplace. So just because a student's studying international history doesn't mean that they wouldn't be absolutely welcome on the trading floor of an investment bank. And just because they've studied statistics doesn't mean that the UN wouldn't welcome them with open arms. And that is, for me, that's the absolutely fantastic thing about working here. I'm working with students who literally have the world at their feet. They're bright, they're articulate, they have access to a wide range of opportunities, and employers are knocking on our door to find them. Having said that, having the LSE brand, as some of our speakers have alluded to before, really does open doors. In order to get invited through the doors and allowed to sit down at the table, you do need something else on your CV. And they're looking for those kinds of soft skills, so communication, teamworking, you've heard the list. LSE 100, as Janet spoke about earlier, is a great way of providing all students with the opportunity to develop and hone those skills. But we also run a set of workshops that are, many of which are employer-led, looking at how they can develop the teamwork and skills, negotiation, that kind of thing. We encourage them to take up work experience where they can, as long as it doesn't impact upon their studies. And the reason that we do that is that one of the things is that consistent academic record is really, really important. I know when I went to university, I was told, don't worry about it. None of your first year marks count towards your final degree. You can have a really good time. Actually, because the labour market is so competitive now, people will look at first year marks and second year marks, and your overall degree classification won't cut it if you didn't succeed in both your first and second year. So their academic performance is key, and we would always encourage students to put that first. Having said that, there's lots of opportunities to gain meaningful work experience, whether that's in vacation periods or through volunteering or part-time work around their studies. But it doesn't have to be necessarily paid work. Through getting involved in student society activities and developing the skills that you need in the workplace, you can do that for a whole variety of activities. What do we offer? This is our website. If you're really interested, you can log on and have a look at it. We have an online portal where they can see the full range of activities that are going on, book appointments to speak to my staff, see which employers are on campus on a given week, look at vacancy boards, get information about what students on their particular programme have gone on to do post LSE, a whole range of things. Just to give you some facts and figures, our vacancy board receives around 40,000 hits a month. Now, when you think that we've only actually got 9,000-something students, that's pretty impressive. And one of the things that's a delight for me working here is about how focused our students are and how engaged they are. Given that it receives such a high hit rate, it's fortunate that we put up between 400 and 750 new vacancies a month, and some of which are ongoing. So I checked last week when I was putting this presentation together, and we currently had 837 live vacancies for students, and there'll be a mix of part-time work, internship opportunities, and graduate opportunities. So there really is something for everyone. I should say that I took over as director of the career service at the LSE in January this year. I've worked in a series of other top flight universities. We didn't have anywhere near these kind of statistics on our vacancy boards, try as we might. The students here are really lucky about how targeted we are. We also run a set of internship schemes, so we have a relationship with the UK Parliament where we actually place students in internships working either in the constituency offices for MPs, or we've just placed some people on some of the select committees. A whole range of different activities through there. We've placed a couple of students in the House of Lords, public affairs, media and policy, and we also have an entrepreneurship internship scheme where we match students with entrepreneurs and they can work in their business for a period of between 6 and 8 weeks. And we also run an internship fair where we have organisations come and promote their internship programmes to our students. As I said, we're really lucky that we have relationships with a whole range of employers. We run 9 different sector-focused careers fairs just between now and Christmas. I've just got back from a whistle-stop tour of Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong and Singapore, where we ran careers fairs in each of those cities for students who either wish to return home post-graduation or are UK or EU-based students who are looking to work on the Asian continent. We run a fair in Brussels for people that want to work in European government, and we run events out in the United States as well, and we're looking to extend that portfolio. For those of you that are from India, we run a Careers in India Day where we get recruiters onto campus. Haven't quite got the critical mass to head out to Mumbai yet, but we're working on it. This is what's on our website. We're really lucky here that we still have the resources to be able to provide students with one-on-one personalised careers advice. And that's quite special because in many universities that's being cut right back and students don't have access to that individualised support. But we think that it's something that's special about the LSE, and it's something that we can provide that gives our students an edge when they're preparing for their applications. So we offer careers guidance, CV writing, mock interviews, you name it. And if you're interested and your sons and daughters are insisting that there's nothing there for them at all and you want to have a quick look and check, you can check our website. We've got a Twitter page. We've got a series of blogs and we're on Facebook as well. The one last thing that I should say, just because if anybody was watching the news this morning or has been following the financial markets, it does look a tiny bit bleak at the moment economically. Master of understatement. I won't say that we're looking down the barrel of a gun or whatever it was David Cameron said the other day. I don't want to come over and be overly optimistic about it because these are tough times for graduates. The Association of Graduate Recruiters did a survey this year, and across the full range of graduate recruitment schemes, there's now at least 83 applications per place, and for some organisations it's much higher than that. When they did the same survey in 2008, there was 34 applications per place. So you can see how it's getting competitive. What I would say is that we've tracked our graduate data. We've gone back through how our students did at the beginning of this financial crisis in 2008 when the markets first crashed, and our students are still outperforming the marketplace. And that's because a lot of the recruiters have pulled back off university campuses across the UK and focused on a smaller unit. So they are still recruiting talent, they're just being pickier about where they get that talent from. So they need to work hard and they need to engage and they need to think about where they want to go and develop that skill set. But it's not as bleak as the news makes out, particularly not if you're studying here.
Hello? Can you hear that? Is that... Hello. Hi, I'm Alex Peters-Day. I'm General Secretary of LSE Students' Union. Every year, four students are elected full-time to work for LSE students for 1 year. So I'm here to talk to you about what life was like at LSE, what life is like in London, and then what opportunities LSE students have for students here. It's an absolute honour to be here. LSE is one of the most prestigious universities in the world, and we work hard to make sure that LSE Students' Union is equally matched in order to provide the greatest possible student experience for students here. LSE Students' Union is an independent and not-for-profit organisation. So LSE is an amazing institution, and I feel so fortunate to have studied here for 3 years. I studied social anthropology, and to be able to study alongside some of the greatest academics of our time has been a privilege, and the support I receive from my department, the school, and the Students' Union has helped develop both in an academic and a personal sense. As General Secretary of the Students' Union, I also feel incredibly lucky to be able to represent the views of LSE students, some of the most passionate, dedicated, and hard-working individuals in the world. I'm also looking forward to working with the brilliant staff we have here at LSE, some of whom we've heard from today, in order to ensure the school remains one of the greatest universities in the world. I remember sitting here 3 years ago during my orientation. I was a little bit nervous, a little bit confused, but also very, very excited. On Sunday, we officially start our orientation festival. That's a 2-week schedule of events designed to ensure that LSE students start off on the right foot here. We hold socialising and networking events, drop-in and information services, hold tours around LSE and London itself, and overall work hard to ensure that students are settled, happy, and ready to begin the year, fully prepared. Staff in the Students' Union and us have been working, and the school have been preparing for this for months, and so we're so excited that on Monday, we can finally begin and meet all the incoming students. So onto the Students' Union itself. As I mentioned, one of the main things we do is provide representation. And this are the four students who are elected this year. As General Secretary, I'm the primary representative of LSE students to the school, to the media, and to the wider world. I sit on committees across the school, some of the highest up committees, to ensure that the school is listening to students. And I also chair the Students' Union Executive to ensure that every officer is working hard. Amina is our education officer. She's the leading student voice on academic issues. She chairs an education assembly and is the leading student voice on academic affairs, both within the LSE and nationally. Lucas is our community and welfare officer, chairs the welfare and community assembly, takes a lead role in coordinating on accommodation issues, works on creating a greener society, an ethically responsible school, healthy living and student support. And Stanley is our Activities and Development Officer. He has overall responsibility for developing societies, the media group, sports, raising and giving, volunteering and working with students to achieve a fun LSE. As well as this, we have a part-time executive of students who have been elected to represent particular groups or issues within the LSE. These are all current students who juggle students' union responsibilities alongside their university life. So we have students supporting particular areas, liberation campaigns, and key groups. And then there's activities. Activities are all run by the students' union. I'm going to talk here about societies, sports, the media group, and RAG. We have 220 societies at the LSE, in pretty much anything you can imagine and want to get involved in. Whether students are looking for careers networks, religious, national, or cultural societies, hobbies, food and drink, if there is something that is not offered, it's also incredibly easy to set up a society. The vast majority of students at LSE are involved in at least one society. Over 7,000 students at LSE are signed up. In the past year, we've had incredible achievements made by students in societies. From the Debate Society flying to Botswana for the Debate World Championships and placing fourth in the world, to the Japanese Society raising over £10,000 in 1 week following last year's tsunami, to the Drama Society taking a production entirely written, produced, acted and directed by LSE students up to the world famous Edinburgh Fringe Festival this year. Within the Athletics Union, or the AU, there are 40 sports clubs playing a huge range of abilities. We have our own squash courts here on campus, and there is an LSE sports ground at Berrylands, just a 15-minute train ride from Waterloo. Over 3,350 students are involved within the Athletics Union in one way or another. We have students winning and competing in University World Games, to students who have never played a sport in their life and who just want the social side. We cater to all abilities. And there's Timeless. Timeless is a huge production that is entirely done by students. From singing and dancing, to backstage work, costumes, script writing, marketing, and directing. Last year, it was held at the Hammersmith Apollo. Over 1,500 audience members were there and saw the Timeless raise £10,000 for charity. It's an opportunity for LSE students to show off the great diversity and cultural diversity amongst the LSE student body. And we also have an award-winning media group. Many talented and some not so talented journalists and broadcasters who go on to achieve fame or go on to achieve infamy have passed through the world of LSE student journalism. The media group is made up of The Beaver, which is a weekly student newspaper, Pulse, our radio station, and Loose TV, who are our TV network. And there's also Clare Market Review, a journal which existed from the early days of LSE and run by students, and it is now an incredibly successful creative outlet for thousands of students every year. And there's also Raising and Giving, or RAG, which literally raises money and gives it to charity. Now, some cynical people might say that LSE students are already pretty good at extorting money from their friends and family. So if they've mastered that particular fundraising skill, RAG gives students the chance to do that for charity. We work all year round with creative and fun activities, such as skydiving, trips to other cities to street fundraise, hitchhikes to Amsterdam, and so much more. Last year, we raised over £30,000 for charity. I was president of RAG last year, and it was really down to the thousands of students who get involved, and every year we're able to knight the campus around a few good causes. Taking on a position of responsibility within a society or a sports club or the media group equips LSE students with transferable skills that can make you more attractive to prospective employers. However, the most fulfilling way to develop new skills is through an activity you're enthusiastic about. LSE Students Union activities deliberately attempt to ensure LSE students remain incredibly employable and equipped for the future whilst having a brilliant time here at LSE. And there's campaigns. We've run a number of successful campaigns in the past few years. And we're proud of being an active, participatory and campaigning union. In recent years, this has included achieving a London living wage for all staff at the LSE, to ensuring the LSE nursery stayed open, and ensuring Wednesday afternoons were kept free from lectures and classes so as to ensure that students can fully participate in the great activities I mentioned earlier. This year ahead, we're looking within London to work on the London mayoral and GLA elections, which are taking place in May, ensuring that the voice of the 500,000 students within London is heard. We're also focusing on environmental and volunteering and ethical investment, as we're saying, that ethics should inform everything we do here at LSE, and indeed, the only way is ethics. There's also one really unique way for LSE students to make a difference in the union, and that's something called the Union General Meeting, or the UGM, which happens every Thursday, 1 p.m, in the Old Theatre. This is absolutely unique to LSE. No other students' union in the country can have a weekly meeting of hundreds of students coming together. This is where students direct the policy and the campaigns of the union. Any student can attend, any student can write motions, which are ideas of what they want to change, and they are voted on by any student. The LSE director attends once a term, as well as the National Union of Students president and a number of other key figures within LSE. It's also the chance of all the officials and representatives I talked earlier to stand up and get asked and questioned every week to ensure that we are working hard for students. As well as being an active and participatory organisation, the Students' Union also exists to look after student welfare and provide safe, affordable services here on campus. We have a completely free and confidential advice and welfare centre on the second floor of the East Building. Our advisors specialise in immigration advice, visa advice, as well as providing advice on housing, finances, studies, and any other areas which students might find difficulties. We run the service as a source of comfort and help that is independent from the school. It's there when things go wrong, and it's there to help to stop things going wrong in the first place. We also run a range of services, such as a gym, shops, cafes, a pub, a copy shop, all meaning that LSE students have quick and easy access to a high range of high quality and affordable services on campus. Living in London is an absolutely incredible experience. I'd argue it is the greatest place on earth to be a student. LSE is one of the only universities in campus that is located within its own campus. Students will find ample opportunities to network and socialise with each other, and everything is located within a conveniently close location. LSE's location within London is also fantastic. For any students who are budding lawyers, we are right next to the Royal Courts of Justice and the Inns of Court. The City of London and the Financial District is only a short walk away, as is a historic Fleet Street. Covent Garden's proximity to LSE means students have the opportunity to watch free street theatre each and every day, as well as browsing the shops, the market stalls, and people watching. The amount of theatres nearby means LSE students can take advantage of the incredible student discounts available. Many theatres offer tickets for just £10 for students. The British Museum, storing some of the Earth's greatest artefacts, is located only a short 10-minute stroll through Bloomsbury. And within London, there are enough art galleries and museums to keep even the most eager culture vulture satisfied. University is about the experience that you gain from it. And the Students' Union is there to make sure that LSE students have the best experience possible. I graduated LSE in July, having studied social anthropology for 3 years. And before I came to LSE, I was absolutely terrified. I come from a little town in North Yorkshire, and so while all my friends were going to Leeds or Newcastle or staying local, I decided to head off alone to the big city. I knew LSE was academically outstanding, but I was convinced I wouldn't be able to settle in or make friends. All I'd heard about LSE was that students were incredibly hardworking, spent all their time in the library, and just seemed entirely different to myself. And then I got here, and I had a fantastic time. I was in Rosebery Hall. I actually was president of my hall, which is the governance structure we had earlier, that Rachel mentioned earlier. I got involved within the Students' Union. I went to my departmental induction. I met staff, I met friends from countries that I never even knew existed hardly. I mean, I was right about one thing, students do work really hard here, but it's about getting that right balance. Succeeding academically while developing those all-important softer skills, which are so important, and creating the networks of friends and colleagues that will last you through life. LSE students are famous for their passion, for their hard work, and for their achievements. In this year's intake of LSE are people who will go on to change the world. They may be Nobel Prize winners, world leaders, business entrepreneurs, writers, or any leader in their field. Through representation, campaigns, activities, welfare, support, and more, the Students' Union is here to ensure LSE students achieve their full potential. We will ensure they start off on the right foot, support them whilst they're here, and help them into the future. The Students' Union is here for LSE students every step of the way. Together with the school, we work to ensure that LSE offers students the most fulfilling time possible here, and that LSE students continue to go forth and change the world. Thank you very much for coming. Myself and my fellow sabbatical full-time officers will be at the reception later. So if you have any questions about life at LSE or the union, just come and grab us and talk to us. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. On behalf of all of you, I should like to thank the speakers for their informative presentations. Lots of details there, and I hope they've answered some of your questions and possible concerns. We now have time for a few questions, preferably questions which you think will be of interest to the audience, rather than more personal questions that we can deal with separately. Hopefully there are some roaming microphones. Yes, so if someone would like to fire away with a question. One down here.
Thank you for all the information. In a competitive, highly competitive industry like, and I would call it the industry of education, there wasn't enough information about how strong is the LSE alumni network, and how does LSE network or leverage that powerful network to sort of give us future students the advantage of that.
The LSE alumni community is incredibly strong, and if I can give you a really practical example of how we've leveraged that for current students, as I was saying, we run a series of careers fairs in Asia for students who want to return back to that region, and Kenneth Lai, who's president of the Hong Kong Alumni Association, was absolutely instrumental in helping us put that event together, talking to local employers about, I was going to say selling the LSE students to the employers, maybe that's a bit strong, but about being a real brand ambassador for the LSE and making sure that employers in that region are really keen to take students on. I sat as part of the committee that looked at the executive membership of the LSE Alumni Committee, and we've got some really passionate people who are looking at, there's a lifelong contacts committee who are looking, each country's got an individual chapter that looks at running events in that chapter. There's a group which looks specifically at making sure that people get briefings before they come to the LSE, and that when they return to their home countries, there's things there. And there's also a really vibrant LSE alumni community who are utilising LinkedIn as a tool to talk to each other about opportunities in their companies to make sure that people are able to contact the right people as well as through the official alumni association. So I think today we've been really focused on what happens to the students whilst they're actually here and the support for them, because this is their first week, and that's where our focus is at the moment. But rest assured that is a really strong link. And for my part, at least, LSE alumni practically fall over themselves to come back and talk to the current students about what they're doing now and what they wished they'd known when they were in their shoes. So we do make the most of it, I promise.
I can endorse that. If you're an alumni, after you leave, you stay an alumni, and you get inundated with information, the organisations of other alumni. There's the website. There's just so many alumni around who can help you.
And just to say that if you noticed I was the last onto the stage today, that's because I was having lunch along with Alex with the LSE Alumni Executive Committee, who were all on campus for a conference today to meet each other and look at ways of strengthening that network even further.
Well, there's one at the back.
Hi, I have a more practical question. I'm a mother of a foreign student, and if you could just say a few words about the medical services that are available to students, I would really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes, I'm sorry. There was a mention of the St. Philip's Medical Centre on one of my slides, I think, and I glossed over that to try and make sure I didn't overrun my slot. But international students are entitled to the full medical provision as though they were a UK citizen while they're studying here, so they're completely covered by the National Health Service. They're entitled, obviously, to register with a local doctor and to use the hospital services if there is an emergency. Most students who are newly arriving at the school will be able to register with the medical centre on campus. That's not the case for absolutely everybody. I think if anybody is staying in one of the halls of residence south of the river, they'll need to register with a doctor close to the hall of residence, but the halls themselves will be able to give advice on which medical practice they ought to register with. So either way, any international students will be properly cared for. And it's a very good point to raise, because I should have stressed that it's very important that students don't wait until they get ill before they start registering with the doctor. It's important that they do that as soon as they arrive, ideally, so that they've got that protection in place, so that if there is anything that happens over the next 3 years, they don't need to worry about the administration. They've got a doctor that they can get in touch with immediately and receive instant help. And similarly, the medical centre that we do have on campus is extremely useful at helping out if we do have any emergencies during the day-to-day at the school. They're not too precious about who happens to be registered with the centre. They'll help any students that need emergency assistance. But any international students are covered. They should register as soon as possible. And if they're not able to register on campus, the hall that they're staying in will be able to advise them.
Front.
Yes, thank you for this wonderful introduction. How do you want our role to, how do you see our role as parents, other than supporting our children in a more institutionalized way, the association and so forth?
I mean, that sort of stability students have. We try to provide it in the school, Gavin, students, union, all the support that we have, but ultimately parents are the key support for students. And, you know, it's a very exciting time for students. It can be a very challenging time as well. So I think what I ask you to do is to listen to them. They do come home, you know. They come home at Christmas. And they come home, mine came home with so much underwear. I didn't know we had so much underwear. It was 7 weeks of underwear, it seemed to me. So they do come home, and you know, they will want to talk about their experiences. Some things may not have gone well. I mean, they come somewhere like the LSE, having been top or near the top of their class at the school they were at. Sometimes that can actually be quite a shock to the system. And then there's the other side of students, which I sympathise with, because I was one of these, who spend about a year and a half thinking they must be the worst student that the university's ever taken. One day they're going to get a message in their pigeonhole saying it was all a terrible mistake, and then suddenly they realise they're actually quite good. So I think one has to be sensitive to the challenges that students face, which are financial challenges, of course, but not just financial challenges. So, you know, I hope very much that we would give them their support in their first and second year. Don't press them in their first and second year to go to Jenny straight away and get a job and earn lots of money. They've got time to think about that. They've got to reflect about what they want to do. And 3 years is quite a long time to reflect about that. So I guess this is more as a parent and a pro-director. Please give them your support. Realise it can be difficult. London can be difficult. And, you know, if they are in any problems at all, tell them the LSE is still quite a small place. It's still quite a warm place. And they must go and seek help. And if they're having an absolutely wonderful time, this is very, very happy for them. You know, that's what we want.
This one down here.
Thank you. Please, I just want to find out about the accommodation fees. We talked about fees before on the deadlines. Do the same deadlines hold for the accommodation fees? Because we've done the school fees, but like my son just got something about accommodation today, and I wondered if there was a deadline for that. I did hear that it had to be paid for the whole term. If we could have some more details, please. Thank you.
Sure, of course. Let me make sure I understand the question. You want to know about are the payment deadlines the same for accommodation for fees? Okay. The rule of thumb is this, that the accommodation fees are due on the second Friday of each term. So they're in three payments across the year, the second Friday of each term. So the first payment date is the 7th of October, which is the day before my birthday. Thank you. Information is available to students when they check into their accommodation. So it is written down somewhere, and we do contact students as well, just to remind them. Thank you.
That's a lady down here at the front.
Actually, that was my question. I picked up the dates that you had, and you did say that you could pay online, but I wasn't sure if I would be able to pay online on behalf of my son, or if it was up to him to sort it out himself.
Yes, you can. You can pay for him.
And he can give me the details?
He can.
So that means I need to ask you then?
You will. No, I'm very happy to, if you would like some more information, I am available at the reception later on, so I will make sure that you get that information if you'd like it.
Any more?
I've just got one other question, and that is, a student embarks on a course and finds that halfway, perhaps, you know, two terms later, the course is not quite suited to the student's interest. What sort of advice do you give for the student at that stage? Just to...
It's Gavin and me, really. I mean, Gavin was supposed to talk about the technicalities of this, but before I became president, I was departmental tutor at the Department of International History. Students do make mistakes. I think the important thing, first of all, they make a mistake, is to recognize that they make a mistake rather than wallow in it for 3 years. Usually, it's not a mistake when they think that they come to study economics, but actually they should have been studying something entirely different. It's normally a sort of a nuance. If they're doing a joint program, they realize they should have moved, you know, perhaps to single honors in one subject or vice versa. Occasionally, a student realizes they've made an enormous mistake, and actually they learn London, they learn different day one. And I think what you advise students to do in their circumstances is, first of all, to speak to their academic advisor. Every student has an academic advisor in the department. And then probably to go on from there to speak to the departmental tutor. And we can deal with this sort of thing. Sometimes it's a question of moving a student within the year into another program. Sometimes it's a question of actually saying, okay, you've got to start again. And that, of course, has financial implications. But in the longer term, it's a better option than sticking it out for the 3 years. Very occasionally, the student themselves will make a decision if they want to go somewhere else, and then we release them with that. So, I mean, there are structures in place. It does occasionally happen. And I think what you have to do is, if you're unhappy, you have to seek the help early. If you can't let it go to the end of the first year, then you do badly in the exams, then people will be a major mistake. It has to be addressed, you know, really, as soon as it becomes clear the problem. I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
There probably isn't an awful lot for me to add, I don't think, but it just to reiterate what you're saying, really, is that often students will come and see me to say that they're wanting to either interrupt their studies for the year, or they're wanting to transfer program because they're not happy, or they don't really know what they want to do, but they know that something isn't right, and they seem to feel slightly reluctant to suggest that there is any kind of problem. And if they come and see me around Christmas, they think it's some kind of disaster that things have gone wrong so quickly, and that really isn't the case. It's very good that students do highlight that there's a potential problem as early as absolutely possible, because it then means that they've got the opportunity to speak to their tutor, speak to their departmental tutor, assess whether it is a genuine problem, whether it's something that could be solved by transferring to another program, or if it's something that's got a simpler solution, and that a program transfer isn't the most appropriate course of action. But where it's far more problematic is when students get to their final year and suddenly realise that this isn't the programme for them. They've battled through it, they've hated every minute of it, and it's really, you know, pretty much too late then to make the change. So it's important that students take advantage of all the support networks that I was talking about earlier, and don't think that those support networks are only there for when there's a crisis and when there's absolutely no other alternative. They're there for students to take advantage of before a problem occurs. So I would just encourage them to make sure they keep in touch with their academic advisor at the very least.
That's one of the lady out here.
What are your options if a student wants to study the second or the third year abroad?
We need to wind up now. If you still have any questions, then please make a note of them and put them into the question box with your details, and somebody will respond to you. However, my message to you is, do not worry. You'll find that your children are surprisingly resilient and independent. I used to phone my parents once a week from a payphone. They now have mobiles, BlackBerries, email and Skype. They all keep in touch, particularly, as has been said, when they want their washing done or when they need some more money. That really finishes this afternoon's presentation. There are now tours of the campus, and on your seat there should have been a slip of paper that says which tour you're on and which exit you need to go to. The exits are marked around the room. They start outside the theatre. And I'll see you again at the drinks reception, which is in the senior dining room, which is on the fifth floor of the old building, where at about 10 to 6, George Gaskell will make a short speech. Thank you very much. Enjoy the tour.